in a series right now in the book of Job, and we're going to continue that series, and we're talking about suffering and God's providential sort of protection within it, and what that means, and how we're supposed to see that, and what a healthy perspective on that is. Truth be told, too many of us know a story similar to the one we just saw in the video. And if not that story, we've experienced another story, some other level of or type of suffering, type of story where a person or a family goes through something that is nearly without words. Just this week in my own life, in my pastorate, I've been kind of walking from a distance, but walking alongside a few different stories of suffering. One story I shared with you last week is the five-year-old little boy Keaton, who's wrestling and continuing his battle with leukemia over at Dornbecker there. Also this week, there was a murder-suicide outside of our church with a man in town that I happen to know, and so I'm walking alongside him with that. His mother was actually shot and killed just a few days ago, and then her husband, his stepdad, then took his own life. And then, as many of you know, another story of loss is the loss of Daryl Kennedy, who passed away just within the last few days. And he was a man who influenced my life and also many others in the Christian community, who he fell and he didn't recover from that fall, and he was rescued to be with Jesus just recently. This is just what's happening in my small world, and I'm sure there's just as important, if not more severe, stories of suffering happening in your world. And so as a Christian, we're faced with the reality of these sufferings, and oftentimes when we're walking with our non-believing friends, it's one of the primary questions they ask, which is, if you believe in this God, why would these things happen? And what can we do about it, and what does it mean? And it's hard stuff. And so today, I'm gonna preach a not recommended sermon. Some might call it an unpreachable sermon, which immediately drew me to the sermon in and of itself. It's a talk that is wonderfully complex. Wonderfully complex. And so I need to make sure and give credit to my resources, Dr. Larry Shelton, who's here today. He's a retired seminary professor, helped me with this. And then when you know a retired seminary professor, he actually knows other seminary professors, which is wonderful. And he connected me with Dr. John E. Hartley, who actually wrote the commentary on Job that we've been able to dialogue with through email. And the reason I share that is because, as I said, this is a wonderfully complex message, and I want to make sure you know that I'm not just making it up. That I really spent a lot of time with today, but I also want you to realize there's going to be points in the sermon when your brain just goes, ow. Like that I'm not sure I understand that, and that's okay. I've spent a lot of hours on this, and it took me some time to articulate it. And if you have questions, the sermon will be online. Go back, listen to it, or write it down, or you can email me. But today's stuff, I think, is pretty profound, and I'm really excited to share it with you. So reviewing last week when we opened the series on Job, I want to remind you that God decided to test Job's character to see how his commitment to him would bear up under adversity. God boasted of Job's righteousness and his behavior to Satan, and Satan responded in Job 1:11 by saying, "Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and Job will surely curse you to your face." Satan, the administer of the curse, brings back up the curse by saying to God, "Do these things to Job and he will curse you right to your face." God grants Satan permission to strip Job of his possessions and his family and to afflict him with excruciating boils. Job at first accepted his plight. In Job 1:21, he said, "The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Now, I want to bring some clarity to that, because I had a lot of people say, okay, that's how you're supposed to suffer. You're supposed to suffer like Job. Your family gets taken away. Your child is born too early. Something happens, and you're supposed to yell out like Job, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." And I think perhaps at first onslaught, for many of us that have walked with God for many years, this may come very natural. You don't know what else to do. You can't scream out. You can't shout. There's no one you can go after. It's no one's fault. And this thing is just happening all around you. And so you start with Job, and you start by saying, like Job, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." But I want you to be very aware, this was only the first response. Job, as we're going to see today, eventually does lament, and he eventually does become a man who needs answers. And that's what today's talk is really all about. Right after Job 121 enters the, entering that picture, are Job's three friends. Job chapter 2, verse 11, this is what it says. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came, each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to show him sympathy and comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him. And they raised their voices and wept, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very, very great. It's at this point that Job shares his first lament, because now it has been perhaps months since his family has left, perhaps a month or so since the boils have come, now a week since his friends have come and sat with him, and Job opens his mouth and utters these words. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job said, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it, that night. Let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning, because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes." Job says with his opening words, his really first words of proclaiming what is happening to him and trying to reconcile it to himself, Job says, "I wish I was never born." He actually goes on in the exact same chapter to eventually not just wish that he was never born, but also to wish that he could go to the low place. For living in the low place, the place of the dead, would be better than living in this hell that I'm in now. After that, after he longs to live in the underworld, and after he longs to never have been born, he eventually just straight up says in Job chapter 20 through 20, or chapter 3, 20 through 26, he eventually just says, "I wish I could die. This is beyond me. I wish I could die." Now here's an interesting thing. For those of us as Christians who have walked through hard times of suffering people, or ourselves have walked through a very difficult time, a lot of times we shame or are made to feel shame for times in our life when we wish we no longer lived here. As Christians, we come alongside these people and these places and we say, "No, that's wrong. That's evil, that's sin." I just want to bring forth that throughout the book of Job, God never mentions Job's character or any sin that Job has done in relation to his perspective on life. Now, I'm not saying what Job has done is the right thing. Of course, living in hell would be worse than living now, even in the deepest struggle. Of course, wishing you had never been born when God chose to make you born or make you alive would be wrong. But the reality is, under the circumstances and inside the situation, sometimes we just need to back away and let people utter and groan and hurt to God. Sometimes we just need to be okay to tell God stuff that we would tell no one else. Sometimes we may need to raise a fist with a loud voice and say, "What is happening to me?" Without some holy rolling Christian piping in saying, "Excuse me, are you raising your voice to God? Because that's not respectful. I just lost my child. I'm going to scream." No, you can cry, but screaming is anger. You can hurt, but not that way. You can do, but not like that. The reality is, Job wishes he was dead, wished he lived in hell, because he couldn't imagine it any worse than it is now, and eventually just said flat out, I wish I had never even been a thought on this planet. And God, look at the verses where God reflects on who Job is. God says, "And Job sinned not," because he went before God, and he shared with God what he was feeling and where he was at. And so who are you to judge people in a broken place uttering caustic words, words that they can't keep inside, words that they need to get out. I'm here to tell you today, God can handle it. God can handle anything you can throw at him. So for those of you who need to go home, lock yourself in a room and discuss passionately things that are happening in your life with God, he'll be fine. And he'll listen. That's the cool part. He will listen. He doesn't run away. He doesn't suddenly, with heaping coals from heaven, you know, boil Job's mouth into non-speaking. None of that happens. God says, tell me more. Because he's right there the entire time. But we as Christians, we as Christ followers, we as good friends, we can't handle that. And neither can Job's friends. Job's friends or advisors decided to share with Job after a week of lamenting with him. And I want to be very clear on this, that Job's friends are better friends than you. You may go, you can't judge me. Well, just real quick, in the room, how many people have ever sat with a suffering friend, didn't eat or drink for a week, and sat in silence 7 straight days? Anybody? Anybody? Not a soul. I don't care how much suffering your friends have went through, none of you have probably even skipped a meal. Let alone 7 days without food, let alone not fasting and being a part of this man's life. These people were better friends than me. These people loved this man and had good intent and wanted to speak truth in his life. But these people came from a very unique perspective. And it was a perspective of cherished beliefs. For many advisors, these cherished beliefs are a sufficient basis of authority. For many people with good hearts and good intentions, they have some cherished beliefs, and because of these cherished beliefs that were usually passed down or learned or even worse, helped them through their own difficult suffering, they will sit in the darkness with a person and bring out their cherished beliefs and their authority, and they will share, this is how you should endure. Why? Because I believe it. This is what a lot of us do. It's mistake number one. We bring our own cherished beliefs to other people's situations and we expect them to buy in because they worked for us. That's exactly what these friends did. They all had 3 different cherished beliefs that they were going to bring to Job in the midst of his suffering, but there was one thing they all were in agreement on, and that was that God was punishing Job for some secret sin, something Job could hide from everyone but God. The first friend, Eliphaz, I'm going to call him Eliphaz the Pious. This is Job 4, 1 through 9. And what Eliphaz says is that you didn't devote enough time to God's service. He says, you didn't devote enough time to God's service. Let me read it. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, if one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak. He's listing the good things Job has done. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling. You have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, these things, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. What he is saying, what this man is saying to Job, is God has never punished anybody that did good. And Job, you have done lots of good, but you must not have done enough good. You must not have done enough good, because God always repays people who plow appropriately with appropriate fruit. So you obviously must have plowed iniquity somewhere in your life, and therefore that's why you're suffering. Obviously, Job, you didn't do enough for God. Your religion wasn't good enough. The next man that comes along, his name is Bildad. And Bildad is a historian. Job chapter 8, verse 8, Bildad is very specific with what he thinks Job should be doing and who he thinks Job should look to. He says, chapter 8, verse 8, for inquire, please, of bygone ages, and consider what the fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing. For our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words out of their understanding? He says, we as people need to look to history. We need to look to the teachings of the fathers. He says, Job, you just didn't have enough knowledge. You haven't studied enough. You haven't figured it out for yourself. You're just not smart enough. The next man, his name is Zophar, and he speaks in chapter 11, and I'm going to pick up his talk in verse 4. And Zophar is what we'll call the scientists. Zophar believes in reason. He says, for you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes. And what he's illustrating there through sarcasm is your doctrine obviously isn't pure, and you are obviously not clean in God's eyes. You are not pondering correctly. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? He says, Job, there is a reason behind why you're suffering. There is a method, a scientific truth behind this. And the reality is there is probably more to come because of your own darkness. Each of these men said, because. Job, this is why you are suffering. Many of the chapters in Job relate the faulty reasoning and accusation of Job's three friends. And Job disagreed all along the way. There's two real important takeaways I wrote out for you guys so you can walk this out, especially those of you who are walking along somebody, side somebody in suffering. First one is this: the result of the approach taken by Job's comforters demonstrate that a vibrant believer, remember I said these people were vibrant, that they were better friends than you, okay, I'm being facetious, but the idea is that these people were to the fullest extent believing in God for good things for Job. And that's shown by the way they sat with him for a week in ashes. Job's comforters demonstrate that a vibrant believer does not have to resort to weak platitudes or convoluted explanations in defense of either God or the truth. Job's friends were more concerned with protecting both God's honor and their own deeply held, cherished beliefs than they were with being comfort to a hurting soul. A lot of times, we as followers like to come along people, as I said earlier, and first and foremost defend God. I'm sorry, but you're being disrespectful to God. I'm sorry, but you're speaking caustic words about my God. I'm sorry, but I can't be in the situation with you because you're not sane. The words Job spoke were not sane. And the funny part of Job's entire talk is he speaks them in rhythm over and over and over and over. We all know the definition of insanity, right? It's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Job, for all clinical purposes, was insane because he speaks the same stuff over and over and over again. And we, like these friends, oftentimes come alongside and say, I'm sorry, but he's more important than your caustic words. He's more righteous. And by the way, please don't attack my special cherished belief. Well, I just don't see that my situation is like yours. This is what Job says. I didn't do what you've done. He actually says, I am a man among you. You're not better than me. You've done no better than me. You've done no worse than me. I am equal to you, and I am still going through this. He denies their arguments, but the entire time sharing with them his same insane response that I am just, that I am righteous. And again, God never denies that. And yet the suffering continues. The next truth that I want to bring away from this, a takeaway from this, is that when a person wishes to communicate a word of comfort from God to one who is suffering but does not know how to respond to the caustic, painful words gushing forth from that person, it is far better simply to be present with the one in sorrow, offering a brief, compassionate word rather than searching for profound insight in an attempt to satisfy that person's questions. In such situations, listening surpasses speaking as a means of conveying God's grace to the one afflicted, since a word that strives to defend God with false platitudes fails to defend him at all. Yep. Let it convict. You all have sat with people and tried to bring upon them. I have sat with people as a pastor too. Okay? My knife is just a little bit longer. Sat with people and brought upon them that they need to just push through this, that they need to just rise above it, that they just need to be strong inside the suffering. Hold on. Open your sails. Whatever other leadership quote you can imagine off a wall that you've then used for a person suffering. Have you ever actually used a quote in an office of a person on them? They don't even know it's the same quote. I did that one time to a guy. It was bad. I didn't know what else to say, so I just read his leadership quote off the wall to him without him knowing. It's like the movie Usual Suspects. I just read everything around the room in order to get him to. By the end, he felt better. I left feeling dirty. I didn't feel like I really relied on God. I just read his coffee mug. Be good and no good. The guy's like, I know that from somewhere. I know that from somewhere. Remember this as well as the story continues on, that although Job's friends were confused, although they were speaking instead of listening, although they were protecting God and protecting their own special belief, cherished belief, Job continued to share his objection, and his primary objection was the same, and it was that God was unresponsive to him, that he was not properly acknowledging his righteousness. And the important part for us to know, because we know the end of the book, is that Job was right. That Job was truly sharing, God is not, he's not meeting me where I'm at. He's not setting with me in this. I can't feel him, and I've done nothing wrong. Finally, one of Job's younger friends, Elihu, speaks to this. He recognized that Job's perspective was flawed and distorted. Job had convinced himself that his afflictions served no purpose. He decided that God was simply not treating him fairly. So instead of acknowledging that yes, Job, this has happened to you and you're innocent. Elihu then says, Job, but wait, this has happened to you and yes, you're innocent, but why is this happening to you? Job 33:8-13 is the words of Elihu to his friend. Surely you have spoken in my ears and I have heard the sound of your words. You say, I am pure without transgression. I am clean and there is no iniquity in me. Behold, he finds occasion against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. Then Elihu responds, verse 12, behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying he will answer none of man's words? What Elihu is saying here is that Job needs to open his eyes to a different perspective, a new perspective during this suffering. Instead of seeing his adversity as opportunity for patience and for letting God mold him, Job had grown in his resentment toward his Creator. He closed his mind to the possibility that he could learn something valuable from his suffering. And Elihu wants to remind him that he serves a God who is good and just, and that there is a perspective that is true inside this that both honors Job's perspective of innocence, but also God's perspective of justice. So Elihu does this. He shares a provocative truth with Job, which I just thought was profound. Chapter 33, verse 19. Man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit and his life to those who bring death. If there be for him an angel, he says in 23, a mediator, one of the thousand to declare to man what is right for him. And he is merciful to him, this angel, and says, deliver him from going down into the pit. I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. Then man prays to God and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy and he restores to man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, I sinned and perverted what was right and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down to the pit and my life shall look upon the light. Now, I don't like to give away where these stories are heading, but I just want you to remember this passage and the phrases like redeem and restore and ransom and light. Elihu. Oh, I want to say it so bad. Elihu. Elihu's saying, Job, there's no one that can stop this except some sort of mediator, somebody to come and ransom you, somebody to stand in the way of your suffering. Job, that's the only way you're going to get this, and you need to have that perspective. The coolest part is that Job himself has already mentioned a little bit earlier that his mind is leaning towards this. It's in Job chapter 9. Listen to Job's words. Even the one who suffers, Listen to what he says. Chapter 9, verse 1, then Job answered and said, truly I know that it is so, but how can a man be in the right before God? He's recognizing the distance between him and God in this situation. If one wished to contend with him, that is God, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength, who has hardened himself against him and succeeded. Who's done this? Who has ever won a battle with God? Verse 14, how then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. Appeal, by the way, is a very legal term, especially here. It's a legal term saying, there's already a conviction on me. I must appeal the conviction. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. If I summoned him and he answered me, I would not believe that he was even listening to my voice, for he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He will not let me get my breath, but fills me with bitterness. If it is a contest of strength, behold, he is mighty. If it's a matter of justice, who can summon him? Though I am in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. Verse 32, for he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter between us who might lay his hand on both. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Job recognizes that there must be an arbiter. There must be something in between us. There must be something that can stop this flood of brokenness that's in my life. He gets even into more detail in Job chapter 16, verse 16. I'll put the verses on the screen. This is what he said. My face is red with weeping, and on my eyelids is deep darkness. Although there is no violence in my hands, and my prayer is pure. O earth, cover not my blood, and let my cry find no resting place. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven. What? There's a witness in heaven? And he who testifies for me is on high. My friends scorn me. My eyes pour out tears to God, that he would argue the case of a man with God as a son of man does with his neighbor. Oh my goodness sakes. As a son of man does with his neighbor. Every single thing I just talked about is Jesus, by the way. It doesn't matter about the end of the series. It's all Jesus. All of it. Everything, even the rod that Jesus takes, the breath that Jesus takes. Jesus is the arbiter. Jesus is the one who steps in between. This is ridiculously profound theology. That you understand this. That Job, through his suffering, came to a place that he realized that what he needed was an umpire, was someone to go between him and God to share on his behalf, of his desire to be righteous, of his desire to be holy. The great interpretive question is, who could serve as Job's redeemer? Well, I'll ask it like this. Who had the role opposite to that of Satan? Who is the counterpart of Satan's curse, the personification of humanity's outcry to God? Who? When Satan comes and says, watch him curse you, who's the one that stands against that and says, watch him bless you? Of these proposals, the strongest candidate is God, since Israel effectually called God their redeemer for his having delivered her from Egyptian bondage. This divine title communicated the hope that God would continue to rescue his people from austere situations. It has been argued, my friends, though, that this position is too incredulous, for it requires God to serve as a legal witness against himself. See, the complexity of today is this. We serve a God who is both just and forgiving. He is perfectly just, and he is perfectly forgiving. So when man steps out of God's perfect creation in the garden, and it decides to go and create its own life. And we see that every day on the news and Facebook and inside the lives of our friends and ourselves, where we continue to make choices that hurt people and bring the world into a place that our own children have to bear the burdens of the generation in front of them, only to mess it up for themselves and the generation to follow. When you see this thing and you understand that we chose this for ourselves, God is just to punish this, to say this is wrong, and because I am perfect and holy and I am love, I cannot participate in this. And that power is undeniable in God. Undeniable. There is nothing that can stop the justice of God except for the love of God. That's it. So Job, through his suffering, comes to a place where he recognizes that it's going to take God to stop God. He recognizes that he deserves these things in his life. Although he is innocent, he is still a broken and fallen man. He is far from perfect, and so God's justice must be poured out. And so what does Job do? He appeals to the righteousness of God. He appeals to the arbiter. He appeals to the forgiver. He appeals to the perfect love of God. And we know this because of Job's oath. Job's oath is an incredibly famous verse. It's Job chapter 27, verses 2 through 6. I'm going to read it to you. This is the oath of Job. This is the conclusion of his reasoning, of his faith, of his hurt, of his pain. This is a man who has nothing left to offer but this simple oath he utters, probably covered in ash, laying on the ground amongst friends who are leading him the wrong way. And Job again took up his discourse, and this is what he said. As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood and my tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. What Job says is, I choose righteousness. And then what Job does is he swears by God's name that he was innocent. And at the same time, in the structure of the oath, he boldly accused God of denying his right and making his life bitter. He says, by the God who took it away, by the God who has hurt me, by the God that I am experiencing this suffering, by the justice peace within the God I love, I will still commit my life to righteousness in him. I will still trust my life to this same God. And thus, Job appealed to God against God in the energized setting of an oath. Job knew that what he needed wasn't some amazing miracle or great deed or even incredible healing. He had worked this out inside himself through his suffering. This is the beautiful realization his suffering had finally brought him to. Ready? Even the greatest miracles do not resolve the problems of this earth. All people, including biblical people, who find physical healing eventually die. We are all under the curse. We need more than miracle. We need a new heaven and a new earth, and until we have those, unfairness will not disappear. In the end, Job's redeemer can be no other than God himself. Job needed more than miracle. What Job ultimately needed was the Messiah to come. You really need Jesus. I really need Jesus. Suffering will happen and happen and happen. And what we need to be are people who can sit inside of it and proclaim to the part of Christ, to the arbiter, to the one who stands before the God who rightfully condemns because of my own stuff and my own world and my own situation. I proclaim. I cry out. With caustic words, with whisper, with scream, with groans, that I, without God and without his righteous saving grace in my life, will be utterly lost. No man's knowledge, no man's faith, no man's wisdom, no history, no letters, no guidance, no degree, no nothing will save me from the justice I deserve from God, except for God's incredible forgiveness, grace, and love. And so I stand in the shadow of a cross as a man who proclaims Jesus, and I boldly get washed away into the thoughts of my God, into the presence of who he is, and I boldly live this life not concerned with what comes ahead, not concerned with weakness, not concerned with things of this world, but recognize that I am here to be taught how badly I need to claim the love of Christ in my life, in my marriage, in my family, in my church, in my business, into my world. This is the hope. All men deserve God's perfect justice. And all men who raise a voice and a hand can proclaim the perfect love of the one who appeals that justice, who fulfills that law, who answers that call, and who says, I'll take that rod, I'll take that lash, I'll identify with their brokenness, I will participate in who they are, and I will mediate so that both justice and love can become one in the person of the triune God. That's what this place needs to explode into the community. Nothing else matters more in this community than that message. And people need to live it and feel it and touch it and give it away. They need to learn that it's okay to be less than, that it's okay to shed the things you think you deserve in exchange for the thing God wants to bring you. If you can live in this place, then you will slowly, piece by piece, chip by chip, story by story, scar by scar, failure by failure, success by success, become more and more Christ-like. And people will be drawn to you. You will whisper to them, I found Jesus. I found hope. I found truth. I can pass this on to my kids, my wife, my family, my world. I can be strong when everyone else around me is weak, relying on themselves. This is my hope for you. And this is my message. That you would whisper inside your heart, give me Jesus. Heavenly Father, Lord, in this quiet place, I know there's people in this room who have never accepted you as their Savior, and so I want to give them that opportunity right now. If you have never accepted Christ in your heart, I want you to whisper inside yourself, dear God, it's me. I believe there is more to this life. I believe that I need to rely on more than myself. I'm sorry for my failures, for the way I've put myself above you. I'm sorry that I've worshipped other things instead of you, making them the priority, instead of the one who gave me life and breath. Please forgive me. I believe that your son identified with my brokenness on a cross. I believe that he rose again 3 days later, defeating death and all the brokenness to follow. And so today, I ask, please give me Jesus. Please take this life and take this hand. Give me purpose and a place to call my own. We praise you, Father. We lift you high above.